Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have a highly anticipated episode, and I'm pretty sure I say that every week because I'm always so excited. And that is it social anxiety or is it autism? And of course, I have brought on Amanda Moses. How are you, Amanda?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good. If you haven't checked out Amanda's other episodes, I'm going to put them in the show notes as related. It was so hotly downloaded, the episode around trauma and ADHD. I had so many emails about it. So please check that out. Amanda does some amazing content on her Instagram. That's how I originally found her, around misdiagnosis and some of those really complex questions that I feel like a lot of the listeners who have been with me for a long time, we're really up to more of that advanced content. So check out Amanda's Instagram. I really recommend it. There is so much misinformation out there in social media and Amanda has got it down. Of course, Amanda is a great person to have on the podcast on this episode because she runs webinars on autism all the time. Don't you have a webinar coming up, Amanda? Is that right?
Yeah, I do. This time I've decided to open one up to the community. So for parents, teachers, educators, as well as health professionals, where I'm going to be unpacking what autism is, really going through the criteria to help you understand it, not how it's read in the DSM, because it doesn't do a very good job of depicting it, but actually helping you understand what it looks like when it's internalized, when it's masked, when there's less stereotype presentation, so that if you're questioning your child or even yourself, this will hopefully be something that will help you better understand autism and feel more confident in really recognizing those traits.
Oh, fantastic. Having information that's actually correct is really important because a lot of the time you might go to a practitioner, you might spend a lot of money, and then you may feel in your gut that there's still something there but not get that answer. I see so many people that come back around 5 years later and end up with the diagnosis they thought their child would have had in the beginning. So it's so good to check for yourself. I think it's a great point.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, this is really one of my, I don't want to say pet hates, but it is a bit of a pet hate, where I'll speak to a parent casually or wherever it is, and they'll say something like, my child has ADHD, they are socially anxious, and they've got sensory processing disorder. But then if I say, oh, do you mean they're autistic? They'll say, oh, no. Like as if that's just like a far out alien thing. And why would I ever say that to them? And I've always been like, is that not what autism is at its core? Mm. Which is why I wanted to do this episode. So for you, when you look at diagnosing this clinically or when you're looking at assessing this clinically, how do you start to even distinguish between social anxiety and autism? Like how do you even begin with that?
So firstly, I want to say that sensory processing disorder, a lot of people don't know this, but it's actually not a real condition. It's not recognized anywhere in the DSM or the ICD, which are the two main like Bibles we use to assess and diagnose people. This is not a recognized condition. And so it's really interesting to me that people still throw out this label when it's not a recognized condition. So when I'm looking at somebody who's socially anxious and trying to work out, is it just social anxiety? Is it possible this person's also autistic or could it be both? Because sometimes it is both. Some of those like similarities that we may see on the outside could look like things like, okay, maybe in both instances, there can be some avoidance of social situations. You might see some discomfort in social settings or in groups. You may see some avoidance of eye contact, that kind of exhaustion after social interaction. But the reasons underneath those behaviors, what's driving them, is what is different. So for myself, if I'm going to go for the quickest, easiest way to distinguish between is it social anxiety, autism, or both, is I'm actually going to skip past the social stuff and look for criterion B. Other things like need for routines, rigidity, sensory processing, stimming, special interests. And if I'm seeing any of these traits as well as social anxiety, I know that person couldn't just be socially anxious. There's a very good likelihood that they're also autistic, that this could better explain the anxiety, or it could be both. Now, criterion A of autism is all around social communication. So this is usually where people get confused. But myself as an assessor, if I'm looking for just the quickest way to get to an answer, I'm going to look for criterion B because they're the outliers. They're the things that I should not expect to see if it's purely just social anxiety.
So you're basically ruling out autism to start with by like these things shouldn't be there if that child or that adult is just socially anxious.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, don't forget that these can co-occur because being autistic in neurotypical dominated environments is inherently anxiety provoking. And it will inevitably cause some anxiety because autistic people don't have the same playbook that neurotypical people seem to have intuitively about how to navigate social situations, what the social rules are, all the implicit meanings of social communication. And that's not just draining, but it's also anxiety provoking as an autistic person. There's a lot of cognitive effort that goes into socializing and decoding people's behaviors. And so I would expect some average level of anxiety for any autistic person in social situations that are neurotypically dominated. So the easiest way for me to really try and decipher it at first is going to be looking for those criterion B traits because they're the outliers. They're the things that shouldn't be there if it's just social anxiety.
So what about the internal experiences of social anxiety in autism? Does it feel different if someone is just socially anxious versus only autism and not social anxiety? However, if that's possible, I agree with you, that's very difficult. But how would it feel differently to the young child or to the adult?
So I'm going to get into a bit of the theory now, and hopefully this helps explain it. But with social anxiety, there are typically three phases that we might see that really characterize social anxiety. So we've got the first phase, which is precipitory anxiety. So it's what's happening leading up to the social engagement that they may fear or they may be trying to avoid. There'll be a lot of ruminating, worrying, foreseeing, catastrophizing that will already get that person into a hypervigilant state. This is for social anxiety. The next phase is when they're actually in the socially anxiety-provoking situation. And what I'm expecting to see is the physiological elements of anxiety that arises from being there. Usually there's also going to be that hypervigilance, scanning, potentially avoidance, and really trying to protect oneself from being perceived negatively or experiencing judgment. However, being in the hypervigilant state that you are, and you probably already entered in, you're more likely to make these social blunders because you're not feeling as comfortable. You're not feeling kind of you. We then have the last phase, which is the post-event rumination. So this is the stage where the event has passed and the person is unpacking, decoding, deciphering what happened in that situation. And usually because of their anxious predisposition, they're going to be processing it in a way that reinforces that they have been judged, embarrassed, criticized, negatively evaluated, which just perpetuates the cycle and often leads to more avoidance because the key element of social anxiety is the fear of negative evaluation. Now, the interesting thing is that these three phases that I mentioned for social anxiety are actually quite similar for an autistic person socializing too. But I want you to keep in mind that when it's exclusively autism with non-clinical levels of anxiety, that first phase, the precipitory phase, will be more about planning, foreseeing, developing scripts, thinking of conversations to navigate their social differences. The middle phase, when they're actually in the social event, there shouldn't be a distressing level of anxiety or hypervigilance. There may be some scanning and avoidance due to challenges with understanding the social rules or knowing how to navigate small talk and managing complex group settings. But this is still very different to hypervigilance and avoidance that is purely about negative evaluation and criticism. And in the post-event phase, what will differ is that for an autistic person without clinical levels of anxiety, I would expect to see fatigue, exhaustion, because of that cognitive effort required to socialize and what it takes for an autistic person to navigate neurotypical dominated situations. Yes, there may be event like post-event processing, but it shouldn't feel distressing or physiologically charged like it does with anxiety. It will feel exhausting, draining, depleting, which is a very different feeling to anxiety.
I love that answer. A lot of us see that so many autistic kids or adults are first misdiagnosed or diagnosed with anxiety first. How does this impact what supports they can get and how they feel about themselves?
I think that it is quite common that for many autistic people, particularly those with less stereotype presentations, their first diagnosis will likely be an anxiety or a mood disorder, sometimes even an eating disorder. Sometimes it means that this overshadows their autistic traits, and because potentially nobody's really seeing the full picture and really understanding that this person is both anxious or depressed or has an eating disorder but is also autistic, they don't get the right supports. Because the way that I would support someone who is neurotypical with any of those mental health conditions will look quite different to how I would support someone who is autistic with any of those mental health conditions. We need to adapt our treatment accordingly. And I find that often it means that they go through treatment or therapies that often feel like, this isn't working, this isn't helping, and I don't know why, because this treatment should be helping, but it isn't working for me, and it could even be making things worse.
Yeah, and I think that really comes to a lot of what I see having such a large audience of neurodivergent mums, because so many of us have gone through a lot of treatment where we spend a lot of money and time feeling like it's not working, there's something wrong with me. I've been in therapy for 20 years, I've tried all of these medications. And that can really impact on that feeling of self-worth that comes with being late diagnosed, that I don't think it can possibly be understood unless you've been through that process. Because I remember just feeling so relieved that I wasn't inherently crazy, because you start to question yourself.
Yeah, I often get that from the adult clients that I assess and diagnose. It's this sense of relief, like I finally have an answer, and I finally have a sense of like, this isn't just me. There's something inherently wrong with me, but my brain works differently. And now I understand that.
Yeah. And I think there can be some frustration at psychologists as well. Not that it's necessarily anybody's fault, because a lot of this information is very new and progressive. And I totally understand that. But I think there's a lot of frustration that some people have been treated for a long time by psychologists that haven't picked it up.
Yeah.
And that can be a really frustrating part of it as well.
Absolutely. I'm frustrated with psychologists too. I share the frustration. I'm annoyed that people aren't picking it up. I'm annoyed that people have gone miss for this long, and that I think as a profession, we need to acknowledge the harm that's been done. The fact that so many people have gone missed and under the radar and had ineffective treatments and being mislabeled. And I'm frustrated too. I share that. And I think it's valid.
Oh, I really love that you've said that. I actually got an email yesterday, and it was from a woman who has been late diagnosed autistic, and her ex-partner has just been diagnosed autistic. And she shared with me that they had been in couples counselling for over 2 years. They ended up divorcing, and it was basically all centred around her husband's special interest. And they had kids, and he needed to do it, and she felt like it was selfish, and she kept asking him to sacrifice it. And it went on and on and on, and eventually she left him. 6 months later, they've ended up with this diagnosis because of their children getting diagnosed, and it's clicked in for her how difficult that would have been for him whilst she now has distance. She just shared the level of frustration and regret and wishing that she had have known, and how their marriage could have been salvaged if it was handled differently.
Absolutely. And I think for me, this is why I'm so passionate about spreading information and making information more accessible and trying to train and educate as many people as I can, because I think that it's our job as allied health professionals, as psychologists, to be across this. Even if you're not working in this space, you still have an obligation to understand it, because chances are you could be working with someone who's autistic and not know it. Like, it may not be your specialty, but I think we all still need to be able to confidently just identify it and know what to look for, because it is life-changing and it can impact treatment pathways. I think it's such a fundamental aspect. I was reading in a text recently that they estimate 1 in 5 people in our therapy room as psychologists are likely undiagnosed autistic. Now, that's not to say 1 in 5 in the whole population is, but you've got to remember that the portion of autistic people in the clinical sample, those seeking out help, is significantly higher because of the fact that, how do I even start? Like, all the stuff that autistic people deal with, right? And all the complexities and co-occurring mental health conditions and the struggle of being autistic comes with more clinical complexities, particularly if you haven't been identified. So the chance of an autistic person being in front of you as a psychologist, 1 in 5. So whether you like it or not, it's there. And it's our obligation, I think, to understand it better and to be able to recognize it.
Do you think, though, that influences being able to recognize it? Because I hear a lot of women say something like, I was diagnosed ADHD and then I went to my parents to tell them and then they said, oh, no, that's all completely normal. We do that too because they are also neurodivergent. And yeah. I was just wondering if you're looking at somebody and you are in one of those one in five, do you think that adds a barrier to assessing and diagnosing somebody? Let's say they're autistic, they don't know it, and they haven't done the professional development, so they don't necessarily really understand the autism assessment. Do you think that's why some of the clinicians don't see autism at play? Because they think it's, in air quoting, normal?
I think what my take on it is that, like, our understanding of autism is obviously has evolved so much, particularly in the last 5-10 years. I think what it really is that we need clinicians to be upskilling and being like keeping up to date with the literature. I think it's more about a lack of knowledge and a lack of that training and development because none of us really get trained on autism at university. A lot of us who do specialize in it do training post-university to get that kind of ability to assess, diagnose, etc. We don't do a whole pile at university. So I think that it's more about the lack of training and development and education and clinicians needing to stay on top of that and just keeping up to date with the research and our current knowledge base on it.
So if we talk about masking, how does social anxiety show up in a masked neurodivergent child? And when do we actually start to look at diagnosing and treating?
So I think social anxiety can show up quite similarly for all children, regardless of neurotype, being like that. It's usually characterized by those clinical levels of anxiety. So it's going to have an impact to functioning, it's going to be causing them significant distress, that level of anxiety. And those kind of phases that I already spoke about, and what we're really seeing as a quite a common standard across everyone who experiences social anxiety. But what I would expect to see for somebody who's masked and potentially autistic as well is just going to be a blend of the traits. So the traits I mentioned above for social anxiety, as well as your common autistic traits. And to be honest, again, like the clearest cut way I'm going to decipher is just looking for those criterion B traits and trying to understand if they're present and working out if they are present. How then do I try and understand whether this is autism, social anxiety, or both? And letting that help me then move forward with treatment goals, et cetera, if necessary.
So what should parents be asking or observing if they suspect that maybe the anxiety that they're seeing is really misunderstood and possibly their child has ADHD or they're autistic?
So something that I think has really helped me and others, something that I always teach when I'm teaching differential diagnosis and how to work this out, is that what you want to look for is that one of these is fear-based and one of these is processing-based. Fear-based, of course, being social anxiety, processing-based being autism. And so some of the questions that can be helpful to consider is, what is the function of this social avoidance? What happens internally for that person, or what can I observe, or what do they feel before, during, and after social interactions? Is there any fear of judgment, or is it confusion about the social rules? And do they find all social situations draining, or are there only particular types? I think misunderstanding social rules can be so subtle. More so for adults, I find particularly with younger kids, before they've developed a filter, they're going to have more social blunders. I notice this even when I'm assessing adults and we're looking back to their childhood. Before that filter developed, we're seeing a lot more bluntness, talking out of turn, saying things potentially at inappropriate times, not always understanding without explanation that what they said or did wasn't deemed by others as being socially acceptable, maybe being perceived as quirky. Because I find by adulthood, a lot of these clients have internalized this and learnt over time through observation that, oh, you're not meant to say this. Or when somebody says this, they actually mean that. Or these are the social rules I'm meant to adhere to. But these are all things that young neurotypical kids learn pretty quickly. And we probably underestimate that. So if you're seeing your child struggling a little bit with understanding those neurotypical appropriate social behaviors, this might just be a really subtle way to notice that they're struggling with some of those implicit social rules. And let's not forget that, as we were talking about before, that if your kid is potentially autistic, you likely could be too. And so you may not pick up the differences because you have those differences as well and are conceptualizing them as, oh yeah, like that's normal. I was like that, or I do that, or I struggled with that and I'm fine. And you are fine. You can be fine and be autistic too. But I think that, yeah, being a parent and potentially being undiagnosed as autistic, it is going to make it a little bit more tricky for you to see things for what they are and in the context of potential autism if you yourself share traits.
I completely agree with that on a personal level, especially in the beginning when I was speaking to a therapist. I was like, oh, I don't think any of those goals. I just disagreed with them. And I didn't realize that there was so much shared traits there. I just thought that was all completely fine. And I couldn't understand what that person was talking about. It's like, why would we start there? Those are all great things.
And also I should reinforce that it is fine. Like all of those things you're saying that you've characterized are fine, I think we need to redefine how we're looking at autistic traits, and the way that autistic people socialize is completely valid and fine. And so I think that a lot of us come in with this notion that there must be something here that looks wrong or disordered, or it must be problematic. But because of this old, outdated view of how we perceive autism, right? But all of these things are fine and they can also be autistic.
It's such a great way of looking at it. I think we've come such a long way. When I hear someone like yourself talk, I'm like, oh, thank God that we are getting to this point. Because could you imagine if we were diagnosing as many people as autistic as what we are now, but we didn't have that view? It would just destroy people to put them through what they did 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. The way that we talk about autism and the way that we present it really shapes how somebody is going to feel about themselves, particularly as the clinician when you're working with someone. Like how I present it to a parent or the person, that's really going to shape how they're thinking about what autism is. Is this positive, negative, neutral? What am I dealing with here? Because I've had many parents go through this process and say that, you know, when they were delivered the diagnosis, it's like they're being told their kid has cancer. And they don't. This isn't cancer. This is just a difference in brain wiring and it's perfectly valid. It's just a natural variation of the human brain, which is valid in its own right.
So how does support or treatment differ if the root is around having a different neurotype like autism as opposed to not it just being anxiety? Yeah. What are the risks if we get it wrong and we're dealing with a child?
I think, honestly, they are so different and there are real risks if we get it wrong, because with anxiety, the evidence-based treatment for anxiety will always center around exposure to what that person is fearing. Now, you've got to think that if this is an autistic person and let's say they fear shopping centers, and we haven't understood that this person's autistic and maybe the reason why they fear shopping centers is because it's loud, it's bright, it stinks, it's just overwhelming from a sensory processing perspective, we're going to try exposure therapy with this person. And what we don't realize is that you cannot exposure your way out of sensory processing differences. It will not work. You will only traumatize that little autistic person. It will not work. It will make things worse. Whereas if that was a neurotypical person, that would be a perfectly acceptable, valid treatment approach that would work very well. When you have both, obviously we need to adapt and understand what here is processing based, what here is fear based, and we would untangle that and develop treatment goals accordingly. But it's so important to understand like what this source of anxiety is about. And if it really is just fear-based, we can work on that in a typical way through exposure work, et cetera. But if it's processing-based and something to do with being inherently autistic, we need to understand that. We need to accommodate that. We need to work out how we can build in supports for that person so that they can live like a value-led life, and how we can accommodate them and provide them relevant psychoeducation, et cetera. So it's just a different lens, I think.
There's so much impact on getting that assessment right in the beginning. And I do feel for parents that spend the money and then they go and have it ruled out one time. And I speak to them a lot later on where 10 years later, this all comes out and they're like, but we went somewhere when they were five or six. And that was 10 years ago and it was missed. And then there was a whole pathway, because in fairness of the amount of time and effort and money to go through that, a lot of parents just do that the one time. But yet, as you've pointed out, there's so many repercussions that can come, and there's so much importance placed on that assessment. So I love the way that you are training the psychologists. I think it's really important.
Thank you.
So what gives you hope when working with families navigating in this kind of gray zone that I've just illustrated that can be so damaging?
I really understand that no parent wants life to be harder for their child, or to feel like they're giving them a label that could carry any potential stigma. But the thing is that if your child is autistic, then it already is. And choosing not to explore that won't change that. What it does is it increases the risk that they'll be mislabeled with something more damaging. Potentially it's just anxiety, or they've got a personality disorder, when really the root cause is autism. And when we miss it, we lose the chance to understand them deeply, what they need, how they experience the world, and how we can best support them. And we also miss the chance to help them build a really strong, positive sense of self around their neurodivergent identity. I assess a lot of adults who were missed, and I can tell you that almost every single one of them comes with complex mental health challenges and this deep sense of confusion about who they are. And they're almost trying to rewrite the story of their life with a piece that they never had. And that's not something that any of us want for our kids. And research actually backs this up, that early identification is actually a protective factor. So it leads to better mental health outcomes, especially as identity starts to form in those early years of life. And this is a time where your child's kind of just figuring out who they are and understanding their brain wiring. So how they think, feel, and process the world is just one of the most empowering things that you can give them. Because I think instead of then asking what is wrong with me, they can start thinking that there's nothing wrong with me. This is just how my brain works.
Absolutely. And I think if they're inherently okay with it and they accept themselves, they may not mention it to anyone else later. That's up to them. They may build their life in a way that really suits them and their life. They may feel completely okay and at peace, accept themselves as who they are, and they may not disclose to many people around them, and that's okay. But like having their own sense of self might be already there, as what you were saying, the opposite. Inherently, there's something not right with me. I don't know what it is. And they've got these complex challenges that they are identifying with. It's just interesting that I still talk to a lot of mums now that have received advice to explore autism and don't. It's very frustrating, to be honest.
I think it's fear. And I think it's that fear of a potential label or what that would do to their child. And I think most parents have the best intentions for their kids and really think they're doing the right thing. And I think that what they don't know is, yeah, that darker side that I said, because I'm seeing the outcome of this because I work with adults and complex cases where they're coming to their 30s, 40s, 50s, even 70s. I've assessed people, but they're like, I think I'm actually autistic. And when I tell you the stories that I hear that I obviously can't share, it's a lot. It's just a lot to hold. And I understand parents don't know the dark side and what that leads to when somebody wasn't fully able to understand themselves at such a pivotal point in their life, which is your childhood and teenage years, where you're really forming who I am, that sense of self, who others are, who I am in this world. It's such a fundamental part of your life. And I think that for many people that go missed, we're seeing it. And I know from the research, and I see it in person in my clinical work, the impacts and the outcomes are very complex mental health problems. And so you might be protecting them from one thing, but it's usually leading to another, and another sometimes more dire outcome, which is very complex mental health problems.
And it also doesn't go away. That's what I seem to see. I can see it's like, we didn't want to label her, so we just didn't worry about it because she was 5 then,
yeah.
But now she's 14, and it feels like ignoring it hasn't stopped it. It hasn't made it go away. There are still things there that are getting more complex because now you're hitting puberty and we don't know what's what, but we're seeing self-harm. It does frustrate me because it feels like it's like, I didn't want to label her. And it does have this feeling of, I just thought it might go away because we just ignore it. And it's, yeah, because when they were 5 or 6, you may not have seen that really dark side that you're describing that I completely understand. Yeah. But later on it comes. And then where do you start and where do you stop with this autism then when the child's 14? Because I reckon you're better off when they're 5.
Absolutely. I think also for a lot of kids, demands exceed capacity around adolescence. So even if they've kept it together, things start to unravel and crap hits the fan, so to say, because their ability to cope will usually hit a max at that point where social landscapes are changing or getting more complex. There are new rules for navigating like social relationships, your body's changing. It's a hell of a time, I think, for anybody. And so not having that critical information about yourself and your points of difference and what you actually need to thrive, it can be so damaging at a time that is already so vulnerable as a teenager. It's a horrible time. Wouldn't go back there. And so I think that like ultimately parents are doing the best they can with the information they have. They want the best for their kids. But I think that this is such a fundamental aspect of who your child is that it will not go away by ignoring it. It will always be. The only difference will be that whether you identify it or not, will they get the support they need? Will they be able to understand themselves? Like, you're keeping something from them that I think is absolutely fundamental for them to be able to thrive in their life.
Oh, I completely agree. I'm going to put in the show notes actually a episode called The Worst Assessment Process Ever. And it's with Dina Robertson. And she talks about how she tried to get help with her child when she was 5. She went through 3 assessments, got her diagnosed eventually at 13. And then that autism diagnosis right on that time when she started high school and she was in puberty was incredibly difficult, and how that was for her to fight for that diagnosis over a 10-year period. And the way that Dina talks about what would have happened if they had have got it right from the beginning versus dropping that in when she's a teenager. So I'm going to pop that into the show notes as well. Thank you so much for your time, Amanda. Is there anything you'd like to share before we finish up?
Look, I just think that what kind of gives me hope is just that seeing how much possibility can open up when families stop trying to fit their child into a neurotypical mold and instead just ask, what does my child actually need? And I think everything can shift from there. I will say, if you're interested in learning more and understanding autism, please do come along. I've got the webinar on the 1st of August, and that's open to parents, teachers, allied health professionals. And my goal is to help you feel more confident with not just understanding all the traits, but really being able to better, hopefully, identify and support those autistic people in your life, including yourself.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. I'm going to put all of Amanda's information into the show notes, as well as her Instagram, if anyone would like to follow her on social media. I've also been going to put a listener question box into the show notes. If anyone has any themes or anything of interest that they would love me to ask Amanda very nicely, if she will come back on to explore, please pop that into the listener question box and we will very politely ask Amanda if she could give us more of a time. But for the moment, thank you so much for your help, Amanda, and your time today. It's been great. Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD mum's shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.